Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our special guest, monthly guest, Greg Glaser, and regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is October 11, 2012. If anybody's having a birthday out there, happy birthday. Thank you for listening to these wonderful, informative broadcasts. These are purely educational for those who are investigating for themselves whether they need and want vaccinations in their life, in their children's life. For whatever reason, we have this as a contemporary issue today. You can be part of the educational movement simply by telling your friends to listen into the show. Send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, and use those social networks like social bookmarks, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit. And if you really like a show, you can copy the embed code and put that right onto your own blog so the people who visit with you can learn about it directly and they can stay on your page. And we have with us today both Alan and Greg. Welcome.
Hi.
Say hi to the
We're both waiting for the other one to say hi.
Chime in there. And I have the chat open today, so if anybody is listening, we have a guest here. Put your comments, put your questions, or you can call in. The number is 347-945-6956, or use the little blue Skype button to call in. And if I'm paying attention in the dashboard, I will go ahead right in there and pick up the call. So we're going to get started. Today we are talking about the California Civil Code, section number 3523. And we'll begin with Alan and Greg.
All right. Greg, go ahead and take it away.
Okay, yeah. Given that it's a California Civil Code section, I'll lead here. So the section says that for every wrong, there is a remedy. Now, this, interestingly enough, although it's in the civil code, is not really a law. It's more of a principle of guidance. It's kind of like a rule of interpretation or an aspiration. Basically, the legislature put into the civil code a lot of these common law guidance principles because they wanted to embody them in California. It's a way for a state to aspire to reach a goal in our legal system. So, for example, if you had a civil complaint or if you wanted to have a defense in a criminal action, you couldn't cite California Civil Code Section 3523 as the basis for your remedy because it's a principle of guidance rather than an actual authorizing statute for an action or for a defense. Basically,
can I jump in with a real quick question, Greg? Would you say that would be something, though, I heard you clearly, that's not a remedy, it's a guiding principle, but would you say that is a reason that, let's say, the courts in California should strive to interpret the statutes in such a way as to be able to provide a remedy to any wrong that would fall under California's jurisdiction?
Yes, I would say that.
The reason I ask is because I've bumped up, at least philosophically, if not literally, situations in the past where I find myself thinking, well, if there's not a law that says such and such is a legal violation, then there isn't anything you can do about it. And I have found myself on just sort of a philosophical level, you know, feeling like, well, what happens when something happens that, you know, most people would look at and just in sort of general moral or ethical terms, clearly that's wrong. But if there's no law that says it's wrong, there's nothing I can do about it. And it sounds to me like California is trying to address a really, to me, a very important and broad principle of just human society that you know, if something's wrong, there needs to be a remedy for it, and it's almost like that principle recognizes that, as a practical matter, the written codes are not going to be able to address every hypothetical future wrong that comes up. So,
can you tell us when was this proposed? When was this particular "for every wrong there is a remedy" proposed or put into this code? Civil code.
Its origin dates back to the Roman days, the Greek and Roman days, because it's a principle of equity. But when it was put into California law, I don't recall off the top of my head when it was put in there. I'd guess probably sometime around the turn of last century.
Oh, so it's been around. So
yeah,
that's why nobody knows about it or pays attention to it.
Well, you know, it's one of the really nice things about our legal system is that it is enshrined that we protect equity, that the courts are not allowed to work an injustice. So even if you have a very explicit rule that calls for an injustice, the court will just throw it out. They say, look, we can't apply this in good conscience. It's not going to be fair to do it. And this rule, California Civil Code 3523, for every wrong there is a remedy, helps embody that reasoning of equity.
Now, tell folks real briefly what you mean by equity, because that's really a legal term.
Yeah, sure. Equity, in layman's terms, means fairness. It means that if there is an injustice that occurred, the court will work equity. It will remedy the problem. Or if someone is requesting relief, like let's say there was a breach of contract and they want to receive both the cost of the goods and their lost profit and the cost to repair the goods, a court would say, no, wait a sec, that's a windfall. That would work an inequity. It would be unjust to do that. And so the court would say, look, even if there's some statute that says you can collect all three remedies, we can't give it to you. It would be inequitable. It would work an inequity. So another principle to keep in mind, too.
Can you expound upon that a little bit more? You're saying if somebody is going to the court and saying that there's a loss of goods, there's a loss of profit, there's a loss of money they would have taken in as a service provider or something, that a person can't get all of those things, that they can only get one of – just explain
right.
it a little bit more to me.
Sure. Yeah, it's the windfall rule that's a principle of remedies that a plaintiff is not entitled to recover more than he lost, and the only exception is in where you have a statutory penalty or punitive damages.
And it's really a very simple concept, Debbie. At least as a starting place, it just says that the job of the courts is to conduct themselves in such a way as to come up with a solution that's fundamentally fair. You know, again, with exceptions where if somebody's behavior is particularly egregious and there's, you know, there can be penalties that apply where maybe somebody recovers more than they lost. But as a general principle and starting place, they have to come up with a result that's fundamentally fair. And it seems sort of silly in one sense that we would need to – I mean, that should be a given without even having to state it, and yet human beings being what they are, if things aren't stated and clear, you know, there are people who will do their best to work things to their advantage. And so, I mean, correct me if there's, you know, further clarification for that, Greg, but
– Yeah, I thought that was helpful. Yeah, so
– So where do we go with this from here then?
Yeah, sure. One thing to kind of qualify that for every wrong there is a remedy is that There's another rule. It's a similar rule of guidance. It's not a rule, like a hard rule, but it's a rule for like guiding the courts, guiding people in the right direction, is that if you have a situation where somebody gets hurt but no one's at fault, the court won't step in and apply a remedy, because what they'll do is they'll just say, look, if no one's at fault, then we're just going to let the injury lie where it lies. So, you know, we're sorry, but that's just a risk of living in society. So it's where risk is built into the system.
But is that no-fault insurance?
No-fault insurance would be a practical remedy to deal with risk, but it's not, like, codified. It's not the no-fault insurance wouldn't be part of the law in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
If you decide to go hiking out in the mountains by yourself and you fall off a cliff, that's your fault, not anybody else's fault, and so nobody's going to, you know, have to pay you for that, you know.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. So basically built into the definition of wrong, you know, because our section says for every wrong there is a remedy. So what wrong means is that someone is at fault. So if no one's at fault, then you just let the injury lie where it lies. So just because someone got hurt, it doesn't mean that something was, you know, quote, wrong.
Yeah. And in a way, I mean, people will converse about this, that it's kind of gone to an extreme in some cases, like the McDonald's coffee, the person who spilled hot coffee and was burnt and had this incredible court case, and they won, which is like, okay, you're getting hot coffee, you know it's hot. What are you gonna
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is my biggest, or one of my biggest concerns about our modern society. It's this lack of personal responsibility for one's behavior. Lack of personal responsibility for one's behavior. You know, it floods the courts with needless disputes. It focuses the legislature on issues that they probably shouldn't be focusing on, and it invites people to be nannied, by not taking personal responsibility for their actions. They wait for the government to say this is okay, or they wait for some authority figure, maybe the media, to say this is okay, and they don't have to think about it. Now, I understand that for issues that are massively complicated, like, you know, nuclear physics. But when it comes to, you know, the everyday aspects of our lives, I would really like to see society owning up more to its risk, to its risk behavior.
I think that goes in a sense to the heart of in one aspect, at least, of the whole vaccine issue. You know, the reason that one of the reasons we're in the place we are now is because we, as individuals and collectively as society, have turned over so much decision-making authority for the details of our lives to other people, and ultimately it turns out at least some of those people are saying, here's an opportunity to take advantage of these people. They're relying on us. Now we can control and manipulate the situation to our advantage. And so we have, among many, many other things we could cite as examples, you know, millions of vaccines being required in terms of doses or whatever, you know, being administered on a regular basis under laws requiring them, because we as a society want somebody else to take care of us. We don't want to take responsibility for our own lives. And a lot of that is practical, as you're pointing out. You know, you don't have time to research and become an expert on everything that affects our everyday lives. So it's a complicated issue. We do have to turn over authority on certain kinds of matters to experts. But if we do that beyond a certain level, we invite abuse by people misusing or misapplying their authority or their decision-making power over us. And so then we have a situation like we have today where vaccines, which a growing number of people feel are extremely harmful, and many, if not most of the time, if not even all the time, in some opinions, completely unnecessary, other things that you could do, and yet here it is required, and here is extensive damage being caused by it. How did we get here? And I think in part, Greg, or let me know your opinion too on this, both of you, Debbie and Greg, what do you think? You know, is part of this about exactly what you're talking about, Greg? We're not taking responsibility for ourselves, we've turned that over to other people, and now we're having that come back to haunt us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, on a basic level, we have to examine whether we should take responsibility for taking a needle, sticking it into a child, and that needle has formaldehyde, mercury, and aluminum in high quantities into a newborn baby. I mean, that's just, I mean, we, at some point, you know, I understand trusting the experts, but there's a level where we have to step in and use logic and say, is it logical to inject a newborn with formaldehyde? And you just got to step back and say, look, you know, let's look at this. You know, let's start taking some personal responsibility. And
but we're told that this is safe, legal limits, and acceptable, and is going to help the child. That's what we're told.
Yeah.
Well,
one of the complexities
that
taking a step forward. So that's sort of the moral fabric here, or you know, the background. And now what the law is doing is, for example, we have federal laws that prohibit lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. And so you can see the interplay here between that fabric, that fundamental issue that we were talking about of risk. Basically, what the federal law is saying is that they are mandating the risk. They're saying, look, society, you know, there's a risk inherent in vaccines, and it's going to affect a certain aspect of the population, and we want to prohibit lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. So it's kind of interesting like that. So it's not like there's I think oftentimes the pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine debate is presented as this two-sided issue, but I think it's much more complex than that.
What do you mean more complex?
I
just want to hear, what do you mean more complex in what way?
Yeah, a person who exercises personal responsibility and accepts the premise of risk might also appreciate that there are federal laws that prohibit lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. It's sort of this idea that one is taking a risk. You know, if a vaccine is not mandatory, if it is optional to take it, and then you go in and inject yourself or inject your child with formaldehyde, at some level, you got to say that you're really taking a risk there. You know, you appreciate the risk. Now, not everyone's going to come to that conclusion. I'm not saying that that's the proper conclusion to take. I'm just saying that it's one possibility, one possible logically defensible conclusion. Another possibly logical defensible conclusion is that we want to be holding these vaccine manufacturers responsible, that you can't just put a product like this out, you know, publish a bunch of industry-sponsored papers saying this is safe, contrary to the data, and then just get away scot-free with no lawsuits. Like, we have a system for prosecuting these actions. But so I guess what I'm saying is that there are multiple steps in the process where you might have a person who is against vaccines but also realizes a certain risk component to this analysis. And then that's just, you know, the first step of this vaccine inquiry that with regard to federal laws prohibiting lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. So that's what I mean by it gets a bit complex.
Now, another aspect of that same issue about where the complexity is that we have an enormously complex society, first of all. So, you know, you can't go very far into any issue without getting into increasingly complex issues. And one of the phrases that I heard a lot in law school is a phrase about how reasonable people can disagree. And there are issues that have a level of complexity or multifacetedness to them, if you will, where you could have people of reasonable intelligence who very reasonably disagree on points. But this gets to kind of the heart of the issue here, because when people can reasonably disagree, it follows logically, to me anyway, that people should be allowed to reasonably disagree. And so when you start mandating a product, what you're doing, what the government does, you know, clearly in the vaccine issues, is to choose sides here. And there are people who are for no vaccines, some for all vaccines, some for some vaccines, some for delayed vaccines, some for greening the vaccines. I mean, there are as many different potential points as the creative mind can come up with, and humans, at least in their better moments, are pretty doggone creative. And so the issue here doesn't necessarily have to be one where any one position prevails and wins over all the rest to the exclusion of all the rest. And maybe in a society as complex as ours, where reasonable people can disagree, especially on more complicated issues, maybe, you know, that shouldn't be It maybe the question for legal purposes, for choice purposes, shouldn't be about, okay, let's figure out which one position is really the right one or the best one. But for me, the issue is more about that freedom to choose and the access to clear and complete information. And you will have people coming up with different conclusions, even if they're all looking at the same information and given the same starting place of choose the outcome that you want. I have some suspicions personally about where the weight of those decisions will be or the bulk of those decisions will be, but I think it's the lack of choice that is so egregious, because even in the best of situations, reasonable people can disagree, as opposed to maybe there really is one ultimate best answer for most people or even everybody. That, you know, I allow that possibility, and I have.
Oh yeah, I think that sounds so logical. You know, I think that sounds so logical, Alan. That, you know, if you have two reasonable people who could disagree on an issue, then you ought to let them have the freedom to disagree on that issue. Well, what do you think about that, Debbie?
It sounds like religion to me.
I was thinking the same thing, yeah.
It sounds like, you know, people, everyone is unique. Everyone has a position in their life, who they want to marry, they can't choose their parents, but they can choose who they want to marry, what kind of food they want to put on the table, where they want to send their child to school, what neighborhood they want to live in. And now we should be able to allow people to, you know, choose what kind of car they want to drive. What's the matter with letting them choose the type of health care they want to provide for their family? And the same thing, you know, religion, it sounds the same to me.
Yeah, but well, and of course there is a line, because we are a civil society. We're not going to let people, you know, stone other people in the public square, you know, and things like that. So there is a line. But when did we become a society where we said that the line is that you have to inject newborns with formaldehyde and aluminum?
I think they used a convincing theoretical preposition, and that is the herd immunity theory, because the line is, if you hurt another person, then you've stepped over the line. It's a safety issue. And
well,
that's where
certainly is the rationale.
That is the rationale, but remember, it is only a theory. And
well,
that
and it's
is
also it's also only a rationale, and I'm going to take the thought a step further, if I may, Debbie, that oftentimes, I'll make the assertion and then feel free to agree or disagree, but oftentimes the rationale is the afterthought or after effect. You know, there's in our society, increasingly, I'm coming personally to the conclusion that the money is the objective, and then everything else falls in line behind that. Now, I think there are also, and we've discussed this in the past, other objectives attached to the whole vaccine paradigm, but for a starting place anyway, to illustrate a point, money is the objective, and then you create the rationale. And the rationale is, herd immunity theory has been disproven over and over and over again. The only reason for anybody who has looked into it at all to hang on to it is because it supports a financial-based agenda or other non-health-related agenda. And it has occurred to me in even more clear terms recently when I've looked at, for example, we've talked in the past about all the hundreds of millions, and in some cases billion-dollar fines, criminal and civil fines that the pharmaceutical industry has gotten, and they keep on doing the same behavior anyway. Why? The moral, ethical, and legal boundaries that are out in our world today are boundaries that the pharmaceutical industry regards merely and purely as financial considerations. If they can cross legal lines and still come out with a net financial benefit, they will do so, and there's nothing else about it that matters. They approach this in a very different way than you and I approach, and the vast majority of human beings, I would venture a guess, approach ethical, legal, and moral boundaries, even if we all, you know, drive 60 in a 55 speed limit zone and, you know, on a small level have our own little moral and ethical breaches or even legal breaches on a daily basis, but most of us would not carry it to the level that the pharmaceutical industry does. And so You know, to me, the herd immunity thing is just so clear to anybody who looks at it. Why would they still hang on to it? Well, because that's really the only argument I know of where you can try to justify to someone that you have to inject something in your body because it protects everybody else. If it wasn't something that they could say affected other people, it would be really, really hard to justify saying you have to get this shot. And so, but again, for me, it's not about a belief, really. I mean, a lot of people do believe it because they haven't looked into it or researched it. And so, you know, their beliefs are being controlled by what other people are telling them. But anybody who looks into this will see it doesn't really hold muster. So why are we as a society and the medical community in particular still clinging to this? Because it's a rationale that supports a non-health-based agenda.
Let me just direct folks, if they want to take a look at the New York Times today, there's an article, GlaxoSmithKline, to reveal more drug secrets. And so this is a Reuters publication that GSK is criticized in the past for keeping important information about its medicines to itself, is to lift the lid on more of its drug data secrets. 3 months after GlaxoSmithKline was fined $3 billion, that's with a B, or billion dollars, or 1.8 billion pounds for fraud in the United States, where prosecutors accused it of concealing safety issues, blah, 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 blah. I'm just pointing that out. If anybody wants to investigate, there are lies being told to the public that they are not fully disclosed. And I did want to talk about labeling, but I'll put that off. I want to continue your train of thought that we're talking about the pharma industry and herd immunity, and why do they keep propping up this theory and making people believe it, when if you dug deeper, you'd find that it is not valid.
Well, I'll jump in on this, and I might have an alternative perspective, more of a mainstream perspective, which is that, you know, when we look at the data, at the charts, and show the rates of tuberculosis, for example, or the rates of polio, we find that there is a cycle to it. You know, it has this start. It's kind of like a bell curve, and it starts up and it goes up, and then it starts to tail off. And we see, if we look at the rates of these diseases, we see that there is sort of this time period where people develop this sort of immunity to it. And I think, you know, to completely dismiss the idea of herd immunity is to not consider all of the data, but also to dismiss the idea that herd immunity is not the whole picture. I'm getting lost in too many negatives there. What I want to see is a healthy debate on this issue of herd immunity. And when I look at the charts and at the data, what I see is that, I see a bell curve, and then second, I see that when a society implements natural remedies and good hygiene and good storage of food, like refrigeration of food, its disease rates plummet. I mean, absolutely plummet. And then when I look at, given that, now I'm going to assume, for the sake of hypothetical, that herd immunity is a real thing.
I don't know how you jumped in there. I don't know how you made that cross of herd immunity. Where does it come in?
Let me clarify, because let me jump in here for a second and clarify. Because Greg, you're making an absolutely good point, and you made me realize that I need to go back and qualify what I said. It's not that herd immunity in the general sense is invalid. It's that the idea that that maximizing vaccination rates will provide or create herd immunity that I object to. No, I think you're absolutely right that herd immunity is probably a perfectly valid principle and thing that occurs in the world today, and the data certainly suggests that. At least that's what I'm hearing you say, and I don't disagree with that at all. What I disagree with is that
also,
vaccination is a way to achieve that.
And also, I mean, we can say that even if we put aside all the evidence of pharmaceutical, fraud and all that stuff, let's just put it all away. Let's just throw it all away hypothetically and say that the pharmaceutical companies have our best interests at heart. We can still look at the actual effects, look at the data and say, is this sustainable? should we continue injecting newborns with formaldehyde and aluminum and mercury and live attenuated viruses, or should we rely on what has been working since the dawn of man, which is natural immunity plus organic food plus good hygiene? We can show this works, and we can prove it works. It's similar to the GMO issue, the genetically modified food issue. It's this idea that we know, we can show that if you give a population good food, clean food that's safe and stored properly, their health improves. We just don't have the same data for GMOs. In fact, the data shows the opposite. You know, soil depletion in terms of nutrients, super resistant bugs, and just a laundry list. And that's just putting aside all of the data that we have about the intentions of these industries. Let's just say that, you know, the Dow and Bayer, they have our best interests at heart. You know, even if we assume that, it's still unsustainable. And that's where we can come together as a people and say, look, let's take the smartest course of action. Are we gonna work with what's been working that worked for our ancestors? Or are we gonna try something radically new in the hopes that somehow this data is gonna just turn around and it's going to help us out? You know, I think in terms of, you know, where we want to place our risks, that's why I see that, for example, here's a statute from Minnesota from the year 2010. They say that even in a public health emergency, quote, individuals have a fundamental right to refuse vaccination, close mm-hmm. quote.
Well, I think the one component that Alan always brings in is the dollar sign. And if these large multi-billion dollar companies can't make a profit by proposing and providing good nutrition and clean food and all of these lovely things that everybody wants, and Maslow would call our very basic needs. You know, don't stand out in the cold rain or the snow. Get shelter. Provide a home that's not filled with mold. I mean, you can make a laundry list of those things. It's a society that really is caring, not just trying to make a buck.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think what we do as a society is we start with a strong foundation. So we start with the foundation of we want to be kind to each other. We want to eat good food, good, healthy, nutritious foods, some foods that our ancestors ate. And then we want to promote law and order. You know, we want to be civil with one another, promote politeness and good manners. And then when we have that foundation, then we start, as academics, as researchers, we start looking at evidence of problems. You know, we start looking at evidence of fraud in the pharmaceutical industry. We start looking at evidence where, you know, a doctor or a medical practitioner is making claims that are not supported by the data, whether it's in alternative medicine or in conventional medicine. And from that foundation where we're, you know, we're eating well, we're promoting law and order and good civics, we're being polite to one another, from that strong foundation, we're in a better position to make rational conclusions about our research and about our data. At the end of the day, I think we're going to find that process rewarding. We're going to find it's a nice journey. And that's where I think that law and order come into play in such a healthy way for us. Like I cited that statute from Minnesota as an example where the people of Minnesota are coming together and they're saying, look, here is a fundamental principle that we want to put into our law, that an individual has a fundamental right to refuse vaccination. And it's simple, it's direct, and it recognizes this common interest. It's a way to promote law and order in a healthy way that is true.
Okay, so what is it about the people of Minnesota that they have such a healthy mindset when we know that the pharmaceutical companies are squashing any type of data that negates their proposition that their drugs or vaccines are working?
We're not getting
the information that we need to make a rational decision.
I'm going to venture a hypothesis that it's got nothing to do with the people of Minnesota. The people of Minnesota, the people of a state are not the ones who enact the laws of a state. It's a small number of people called state legislators. The people collectively, you can think of psychologically, a very small percentage of people have a personality type that is a leader personality in the sense of taking initiative. Most people are followers, and this goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the hour, that people look to someone else to tell them what to do and how to do it and to take care of them and so forth. And it's a personality type, I guess you could say, a psychological profile. Statistically, it's a very small percentage of people who are just natural leaders who will jump out and do that. So what goes on in one sense from a psychological perspective, and I'm just offering a personal opinion, I'm not a mental health professional, but the people who make determinations for the vast majority of the rest of us are a small percentage of people who have in one form or another of this leader mentality or personality where they're willing to assume control and give direction and so forth. And that's a small number of people who are making those decisions for a very large number of people. So Minnesota got lucky from the perspective of what goes on around the country nationally, and that they had some people who were in that position in the legislature, obviously, or somebody with strong influence over a legislator or legislators to assert that opinion or position. And then that's ultimately how it gets in. You know, I've talked about in the past how I took an egregiously unconstitutional law here in North Carolina to a state representative who said, that's fine. She didn't disagree with me that it was unconstitutional, but she says, but I can't help you. We have UNC hospitals in our district. You know, there's an example of somebody who had the clout, money, political will, whatever you want to call it, in a sense, the ability to assert a point of view and get a law passed through the legislature. And here's a legislator who herself, to be in that position, is obviously somebody who's willing to take command and control and responsibility, at least to some degree, and much more so than perhaps the average citizen. But yet even she was, you know, trumped by yet someone else. But the point is that what ends up getting on the books is determined ultimately by a small number of people. It's not about the citizens. Now, occasionally, an issue will become one of such widespread popularity or notoriety that the masses will have collectively a strong influence on what happens. But I would venture to say, cynical as it may be, that that's very much the exception and not really the rule in the day-to-day legislative world.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a practical perspective of what's happening. And the legislature, though, is going to be receptive to the traditions and the desires of the underlying populace, and those and you know, there's a lot of family organizations and civil rights organizations out there that are, you know, writing letters to the legislature and providing research memos to the legislature to help them assess bills that are at issue and to also propose legislation. Just as there are, special interest groups with a lot of money that are doing the same thing and also writing laws. And so, you know, I know that in many ways we may be preaching to the choir here on our radio program, but, you know, if there are any militaristic individuals out there who are listening, I just want to appeal to your sense of temperance, you know, appeal to your, you know, bring to your mind's eye right now that, you know, nice Norman Rockwell picture or something. And, you know, think about, you know, what food were they eating at the time? What types of remedies would they use at the time? And, were people in that society hunting down the naturally peaceful members of their society? You know, and the answer is it was clean food. You know, people were polite, and no one was hunting anyone down with needles or injecting like bovine fetus in the newborns. It just didn't happen. You know, and so I want to appeal to that sense of temperance and so that sense of caution, and invite you to take an objective look at the data, take a look at the charts with an open mind. And consider, you know, where the examples that Debbie's highlighting and that other researchers are highlighting, where, you know, these pharmaceutical industries have been issued, penalties for fraud and things like that, you know? Baxter, you know, they had how many kilos contaminated with the H1N1 virus? You know, these are real examples we can look to, and it's reason for caution. I don't cite these examples as, you know, definitive reasons why we must reject everything that comes from the pharmaceutical industry. But I cite it as reason for caution and a reason for temperance. I ask also to refer to the law, the traditions of the law that are protecting our rights, you know, and not overlook them. I mean, I can cite, you know, case after case, Supreme Court case after Supreme Court case that upholds our right, the people's right, to refuse unwanted medical treatment, unwanted physical or mental examination, and unwanted vaccination. That is a basic right that we have, and I don't want that to be overlooked on the ground.
Yeah, but I don't, Greg. I certainly agree that should be, but I think vaccines are typically the exception to that rule because, again, of this belief in the herd immunity theory that your vaccine protects someone else. That's the rationale that's used to take vaccines outside of that arena by authorities and say it doesn't matter what you think about your right about your body because your vaccine is necessary to protect other people. And so in this case, unlike other situations, you don't get to decide what goes into your body. And I think I was very surprised and pleasantly surprised to hear that Minnesota has a law that actually states that, and I'd love to have the cite for that because that's something we should use as a model to hold up for the rest of the country. But I'd be willing to venture a guess that 49 other states don't have a law that says that. And so there's a model to follow, but the mentality is that vaccines are the exception to this rule. And this is why I think it's so important for us to keep hammering away at the herd immunity theory as it relates to vaccines, not that inherently the concept is wrong, because I, again, agree with you that I think it probably is quite valid, but that rather that vaccines are not a way that we are able to get there.
Well, even the Congressional Research Service, I mean, even the materials cited by the CDC admit that forced vaccination is not the law in the United States. We may have situations where you can't receive a federal benefit, like a federal job, or you can't go to a public school unless you receive a vaccination, but there is no law.
Or even private schools.
Okay. Right. But there is no law that will require a peacefully natural person to submit to a vaccination. The only thing I found is that if you have a declared emergency and an individual resists a medical treatment, examination, or vaccination, then the applicable law, whether it's state law or local law, will be applied. And those laws may require, but are not required to require, a person be submitted to isolation or quarantine. So I know I just said require. What I mean to say is that it's up to state law. I don't know if that made sense or not, but what I'm trying to say is that you just apply the law of the jurisdiction, and the jurisdiction doesn't have to require isolation or quarantine. It can allow you to self-quarantine, which is proposed by, for example, Professor George Annis and Wendy Mariner. So, you know, these are very conventional views that, you know, an individual has the right to resist vaccination, resist forcible medical treatment, and is allowed to self-quarantine, meaning that, you know, if there is, you know, even in the worst-case scenario, you know, we have an outbreak of an infectious disease, an individual can just stay on their property. And you're going to be...
Greg, I think there's an exception to what you're saying. I mean, what you're saying is that ultimately no one is going to be, you know, required, physically forced to get a vaccine, and I think your concept is valid, and I appreciate your point and your clarification of that, because I hadn't really gone there in my own thinking at the level that you just articulated that to me, and so I appreciate that. But as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, laws require kids to go to school. Yes, you can homeschool, but in some states, homeschoolers have to be vaccinated too. And so if you're required to get vaccines at certain ages and you're required to go to school, It's not like, for example, you know, you say even if there's an emergency and the vaccine is declared, you can say still say no, and then maybe they'll quarantine you, but you can still not get the vaccine. But I'm not sure that there's an out for some people in some states. If vaccines are required for homeschoolers as well as public and private schools, and
it's,
the law
like
requires your child to
huh?
have an education, to you require, you know, it's not like you. You know, if it was only required for public schools, then you could say, okay, I have the right to homeschool. Maybe it's not practical for everybody to do that, but at least theoretically you have an out. You can say, well, I'm not going to get the vaccine, I'm going to homeschool. But in some states, the law requires homeschoolers to be vaccinated as well, and so I wonder, is there really an out in those states? What's, maybe the state has only a religious and medical exemption, and you're an atheist, and you're healthy. You know, is there really an out there? So I'm not sure, but it raises a really interesting point, though, that the idea that ultimately we're not absolutely required, in most cases there's at least some choice, even if it's not a practical choice for everybody, there's at least some choice that you can exercise and not be vaccinated. But even if that is true in a more absolute sense, it's certainly interesting, but it troubles me that as a practical matter, you know, most people can't homeschool or can't decide not to work in the profession they're trained for, at least not quickly and easily. You know, I have nurses and healthcare workers come to me all the time. They say, you know, how do I avoid this vaccine and how do I do it without getting fired? I can't, you know, and other people are just, you know, they know their department who don't want the vaccine, but they're afraid to even ask for an exemption because they don't want to get fired. They can't imagine what they would do, how they would survive, how they would live if they lost their job on short notice because over some issue concerning a vaccine. And it's that fear that keeps so many people complying with a system that they strongly disagree with. It's really a sad situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think we've seen that example in history as well. You know, whenever you had a public health measure in the past, you know, like, for example, against yellow fever, you know, on the East Coast, that was supposed to be applied across the whole population, the public health authorities weren't trying to get 100% of the people. They were just trying to get the majority, the vast majority of people. You know, there are people who are literally running into the hills. And and I think, you know, the same sort of thing would happen if they tried to do that sort of thing again. And I can appreciate what you're saying from a practical perspective, you know, and all this, but I think from a legal perspective, even the from a constitutional perspective, the authorities currently admit that it is troubling and that it may be required that a state recognize the exemption of an individual because the federal Supreme Court says that you have the right to refuse forced medical treatment, which means that if you have a state law that doesn't comply with that, then the state is not meeting the minimum requirements under our Constitution. You have a right to bodily integrity. And so in the only case that we have that even sort of challenged that was the Jacobson case from 1905. And even then, the court admitted, they said, look, we're not dealing with a case of forced vaccination. Jacobson's free to leave the jurisdiction if he wants. So, you know, it's – and I think which is where we get in the practical aspects, and you know, and I think what Alan was saying is really helpful information. So let's talk about what works and what doesn't work. Okay, so let's really get into the practical here. Okay, so what works? Invite your doctor to oversee your situation and provide input on your behalf. You know, if you are confronted with an individual, you know, an authority figure who's saying that you have to do this, you know, you have to submit to medical treatment, or you have to get vaccinated, invite your doctor to provide their input. Invite your lawyer to provide their input. Invite these professionals to examine the claims being made by authorities. Next thing you can do is prepare your exemption forms ahead of time. You know, but for example, you may not know the future vaccine that's coming, you know, the H5N1. But what you can do is you can go to your doctor, you can have him do an examination of you, and he can tell you, you know, this is how much formaldehyde I think is safe for you. You know, and if that's lower than what is put into a conventional vaccine, then, you know, that's useful information. It's practical information that you have. And if you have questions about the exemption forms, I'm sure.
You know, you're going to your doctor who was indoctrinated into a system that you don't believe or trust, and you're going to have him be your authority? I don't go for it. I'm just sorry.
You know, I mean,
well,
I
no,
think
but what a fascinating question, though. Go to your doctor and say, could you tell me, please, what a safe amount of formaldehyde is would be to inject into my system? And and ask that same question, you know, innocently of some of the other ingredients in vaccines. And, of course, the doctor will – very, very few doctors would have an answer off the top of their head, but it would be fascinating to see how doctors would answer that question and then get that information up front and then turn around and say, okay, so thank you. You've just recommended that I not get a vaccine because the vaccines have this amount in it. It would be really interesting – I mean, you don't even have to make that conclusion to the doctor's face, but it's a real interesting point. You know, I'm thinking, Greg, in a legal context, what a great cross-exam question, you know, to so to speak.
Is anybody out there doing a PhD research? This would be just a great poll of physicians and see if they even know. Because they probably don't have that information at the tips of their fingers. They've never been asked, and they have no concept of what is or is not a legally safe amount. To me,
you mean not legally safe. You mean what
medically
safe? Medically safe. Yeah, I mean I read a few years ago the Poison Control Center in Australia had said there's no safe amount of formaldehyde that can be injected into a human body. You know, so. Yeah. There's at least one official view that says zero for that particular ingredient.
Yeah, I mean, I think what could happen is that the doctor takes a blood sample and then looks at the volume of the blood sample, injects it with, you know, a proportionate volume of formaldehyde that would be in the vaccine for your whole body blood content, and then just observes it and says, oh, look at this, you know, this is killing the cells in it, or this is doing, you know, this, and you know, you might need a mass spectrometer to look at some of the particulars, or, you know, you might just be able to look at it under a microscope. I don't know what the details are there, but I think that the point that I'm getting to as a legal professional, not as a medical professional, as a legal professional, I think that what is important is that if the law is requiring us to do something or if authorities are requiring us to do something, then we can engage the process. And engage it on the terms that we feel are responsible to do. You know, if the system is saying, look, you have to inject yourself with formaldehyde, you might say, let me take a look at that. Let me talk to my doctor about that. And I think the system is wanting us to do that. They're saying, look, we want people to interact with their doctor, you know, and maybe that's a good time to also talk about other things that you can do, you know, preventative measures, hygiene, good food. And so, you know, it's a way to show fidelity to the system, to the medical system and to the legal system. So that's kind of the greater point that I'm making, rather than the details of any particular like microscope technique.
And one of the things I will continually bring up is censorship of information, because if we don't have that, and I see that across the board on the internet, that if you use the Google search engine or whatever, and the opposing views, the alternative views are down on the list, and a person has to really do a lot of deep searching to find out information, except for people like Natural News, Alan Phillips. You know, there are people who are outspoken, but in terms of being manipulated to find information, it's more and more difficult. I fear the loss of information. And just like I said before, the researchers, the scientists, when they learn some information that is against the agenda of the big industry, then they are fired. Just like you're saying, a nurse can lose her job because she has a position that is opposing this great big authority.
Yeah.
I like your pause. We have about 5 minutes. I made you think for a second. I do want to tell the people out there that, one, Greg, you are a constitutional lawyer from California, the founder of the Civil Action Network, an independent media organization offering coordinated citizens' referenda to promote justice, liberty, and sustainable living. His website, Greg, you are at www.civilactionnetwork.org. And also, is there any other place that they can contact you if they have a question or a comment?
That's the best place to find me.
Okay. And Alan Phillips in North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys, over his head in calls and work right now. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He also supports legislative initiatives to expand vaccine freedom of choice. And he is an author on numerous platforms, including Natural News with Mike Adams and also Green Med Info and probably other places. His website is pandemicresponseproject.com. And anything else you want to say about yourself, Alan?
Well, and vaccinerights.com as well. Thank you.
Okay, and vaccinerights.com.
And go ahead and put yourself in there too, Debbie, with Homeopathy World Community.
Okay, I do. I am the founder of homeopathyworldcommunity.com, and it is a platform for professional homeopaths to interact, have many discussions, and the articles are open to the public to read and learn about this energy medicine, how it can be beneficial for your health and get you through many, many problems, health problems, emotional, mental problems. And there are, along the right-hand column of that page, multitude of different places to direct your attention, whether it is for remedy kits, cell salts, computer program for homeopaths, and many of the other shows that we have on air. I'm going to continue today after we close the show, so if you want to talk for another 5-10 minutes, that's fine with me. I'm going to do a little discussion about homeopathy after we're finished today.
I guess the next point that I wanted to bring up, because we were talking about what's practical, what works, if you have an authority figure who comes to you and is demanding that you take a vaccine or something like this, the best way to engage that person is not to threaten them or accuse them, but rather to formally request formal process. And again, that's where having, you know, a lawyer in your corner is very, very helpful. It's a way to keep it professional. Basically, what your lawyer will do is he'll find rules that will apply to your situation. So he'll look at what legal authority the official is claiming requires your medical treatment or investigation or whatever it is. And then what your lawyer will do is he'll apply the facts in your case in an objective and evidence-based manner. And usually, what he'll do is write in this situation, what I would think would happen would be that your lawyer would write a request, which would be narrowly tailored to your specific facts to address the issue presented. You know, your lawyer isn't going to write a letter back to the authorities trying to change the rules for the entire system. You know, that your case proves that we need to throw away the entire system, and that's just, it's just kind of one of the ways that. That works. You know, we look at what works in history, and this is the way to do it. For example, you know, you see a lot of plaintiffs will go into courts and try to submit, like, sound bites from the Supreme Court or, you know, like, one-liners from legal cases and say, look, you know, I proved my case, you know, with a one-liner. It's like, it doesn't, you know, you just want to tell them, look, it doesn't work that way. You know, the law, it's like submitting a physics paper, you know. Even Einstein, with his E equals MC squared, he had to prove it. The energy mass equivalence. It wasn't like, you know, a one-liner doesn't work. And a lot of things is that a lawyer will do is they'll, in court, is make a brief that argues in the alternative. So, for example, you'd say, you know, point one, this local law does not apply to me because of X. You know, point two, even if this local law does apply, I have defense Y. Even if defense Y doesn't apply, can please consider defense Z. You know, and so by arguing in the alternative, you are creating a lines of defense. You know, so if you are the type of person who wants to remain peacefully natural, the legal system can help you achieve that goal. That there is a harmony in the legal system and the medical system, and we can learn a lot from our traditions. You know, the tradition of food and medicine can be very helpful to us today, and is very helpful to us today. The tradition of law and order can be and is very helpful to us today. And And walking that path is something that is a learned skill. So I encourage people to, as I said, start with the foundation. Start by conducting yourself in a proper manner. You know, try to eat organic food. Try to be a clean person really down to the basics. Be polite to others. Think positive thoughts. Keep your posture good. You know, be clean. Be friendly. These are the things. If you have this foundation, it is a great springboard to analyzing medical problems and analyzing medical issues, analyzing your legal rights, presenting yourself in the system so that you are less likely to be confronted with this situation that that harms you or threatens your rights.
Well, Greg, I think those are all excellent suggestions, and I just want to, first of all, endorse them or back you up on that. But I can't help but also react as well from my own experience, where in the real world, attorneys don't always follow the rules, and judges don't always rule according to the law. They're human beings. They're influenced by various things that, and none of us is a perfect human being. We all make mistakes, but some of us actually do the wrong thing deliberately because of whatever reason, you know, is applying in any given instance when it happens. And so we certainly should be able to approach and rely on these systems the way they're designed. I think the designs are fairly sound in my level of understanding, but the way that the systems are implemented is something less than fully reliable. But many times this is what we have to work with, and so we need to work with it, and you should keep a positive attitude, and you should approach people. I advise my clients all the time when I say, look, you don't want to come in with a chip on your shoulder and say, I have a right, dang it. You know, you want to say, in one form or another, you want to say, I appreciate, your goal or your intentions, and I'm really sorry I can't do this because my religious beliefs were opposed to it or whatever the situation is. Really, really yeah. Good, sound, practical advice that you're talking about there. So,
yeah. And then another lesson we can learn from history is that sometimes when things get really extreme, the only advice you can have is the same advice pretty much that the Supreme Court gave to the preacher, Henning Jacobson, in the case of 1905. He can move out of the jurisdiction. It was the best advice for the Jewish people in Germany before World War II, and there may be a time in America where it is the best advice as well. I know that's extreme to say. It's something
there are people who have already been leaving the United States for other countries because of concern about the direction that we as a country are headed. Obviously that's a very small percentage of our population, but boy, the trend is already happening.
Well, we've already all of our industry has left the country, so I guess the people are going to follow. As the next step, and it's disconcerting, really, that is going to be the solution and the answer, just to leave the mess the way it is and let somebody else pick up the pieces. That's pretty bad we can't come together in order to change what's wrong, but we have to just leave it because nobody is standing up. And that is the problem when you talk about the Holocaust. The problem is this one didn't stand up and that one didn't stand up, and then it was my turn, and there was nobody left to stand up. And
well, that's a nice theory, but, you know, a lot of people who stood up got buried shortly afterwards. And so, you know, sometimes there are situations that are so extreme that they cannot be fixed and you need to abandon them. And I'm not suggesting abandonment as a first option or choice, but I think we have to keep abandonment, you know, on the list of potential options, and just assess the situation, you know, as it unfolds, and then do whatever, you know. Of course, everyone needs to decide what's best for them. But I wouldn't rule abandonment out as a plausible response to an extreme situation, if indeed you have a situation that is that extreme.
Yeah.
Right. It's called escape. It's called escape. That's what it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and the reason we bring it up is because it was relevant in history, and, you know, we can show that history does tend to repeat itself. Now, whether that's going to happen here, time will tell, but what I do know, and this is the message I'd like to leave with with public health authorities, what I know or what I feel, what my research shows is that we have the right to be peacefully natural. That means that we cannot be hunted down, public health authorities, because we have blue eyes or because we are Jewish or because we are unvaccinated. You know what unvaccinated means? It means natural, and that's okay.
That's
great
very,
thought,
very, very nice to leave us with that point. And everyone, we're going to be back again next Thursday at noon with Alan Phillips, continuing our discussions about current events, vaccines and your rights in the United States, what's happening with the law. Start learning, getting prepared, and think about what you want to do in your life. And so I'm going to put on a little bit of music to sign us off, and then I'm going to be back on in a minute and do a little bit of talking about Dr. Herbert Roberts and what he has to say about your vital force and your energy within you. So that's it for today, folks. Thanks so much, both Greg and Alan.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
We're into part two of today's Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community Programming. And over the last couple of shows, I've been spending some extra time talking about homeopathy, and most especially the principles and art of cure using homeopathy. And this was written by Dr. Herbert Roberts. Although I have skipped through a number of chapters of his book, I'm going to begin at page one, chapter one. What has homeopathy to offer the young man? And I think he is talking to the people in his profession, but I think it will be very fascinating and interesting for others to tune into what he has to say. So I'm going to be quoting him now. What has homeopathy to offer the young man as a future? And you can extrapolate young man, young woman. This is what he was writing in his day. This question comes to us repeatedly, and in our changing economic conditions, it is a pertinent question. Perhaps we can get at the problem best by asking the young man the counter question. What do you want to get out of life? Only his honest reply to that question can throw any light upon his adaptability to homeopathy, and only upon an honest consideration of his adaptability can we prophesy what homeopathy has to offer him. Why is he thinking of studying medicine? Now, everyone today can get on the internet and search if they have a problem, an illness, a pain, an ache. They can get on and almost be their own doctor. So I think that that's happening, and people are investigating alternatives to taking a pill, which does not really end the problem, because you might be addicted to that pill or require that pill or stronger medicine as it goes along. But Dr. Herbert Roberts says, is he lazy, and does he consider a profession an easy way to earn a living? Does he look upon medicine as a profession to be sought because of its honorable place in the community, or as a position to be desired, a secure to standing in society? Has he an ambition to be hailed as a great surgeon or a bacteriologist? Is he thinking first of the possible financial returns? My goodness, he was thinking about money too, and so do people today. Nothing has changed over the centuries. If he would use his foothold as a physician for a life of ease, for a position in the community or in society, or for a means of obtaining fame or wealth, homeopathy offers him little that he would care to accept. How does he react to the fads of the day, the bulletins of the laboratories, the special advertising of pharmaceutical houses, the glib talk of salesmen? Does he believe that colloids are, after all, homeopathic potentizations? Or is he convinced that colloidal preparations are but recent and crude imitations of homeopathic potentizations, which are inferior and far more uncertain in their effects than the proven homeopathic remedies? And today, many people are talking about colloidal silver, so as an antibacterial agent, and many people take that daily. So I can see that Dr. Herbert Roberts would have a different opinion of using that as a proven remedy. He goes on, if he replies to your question of his idea of the direction of his future so that he leads you to think that he looks upon sick humanity as suffering men and women, that he has a burning desire to serve them, to help them to better health and therefore greater usefulness and happiness, then you may be sure there is a sound foundation upon which we may build a plan of life in which homeopathy will offer him great reward. We can proceed further with our probing of his character and abilities and determine what homeopathy has to offer him by finding out what he has to offer homeopathy. That sounds like a little bit like Robert Kennedy. And what do you have to offer it, as opposed to what it has to offer you? One of the first essentials, now that we are convinced of his unselfish desire to serve, is to determine whether he has stability. If he is mercurial in temperament, easily influenced, and finds it difficult to hold a straight course, always seeking the easiest way, do not encourage him to study homeopathy. Homeopathy is founded upon principles that are in turn founded upon natural laws. If homeopathy is founded upon natural law, it is as basic and eternal as the hills. More, natural laws were formulated before the hills came into being. If a man follows where homeopathy leads, he must be able to follow those laws and to hold close to them regardless of the pressure of influence. Stability of character must have with it, and in equal measure, the quality of patience. In ordinary medicine, the quality of patience seemingly is not so necessary, since we too frequently find in extreme cases where things have taken an undesirable course, the physician conforms himself that, quote, everything possible has been done for the patient, unquote. In homeopathy, one of our greatest axioms is, when in doubt, don't. The homeopathic physician must be able to plan his course, and once having determined upon it, to stick to it until he finds good reason for changing his course. He must be able to wait. The man who considers homeopathy as a possible future must be a student of people and willing to become a student of philosophy. He must be able to read between the true and the false in any symptoms the patient may give. He must possess a sense of values. He must train himself to observe all those signs which the vital energy writes upon the human face, and he must be able to interpret all the signs, which show through habits and circumstances into indications for the health-restoring medicines which he has at his command. Hours must be spent in patient study, tracing the course of the disturbance and the remedy to fit it, always basing the process upon the sound rock of natural law. And here we hear the echo of our previous guest, Greg Glaser, talking about the foundation of natural law, our right to be peacefully natural, and our right to use what our ancestors used as curative agents. To the young man who is equipped and willing to undergo the training for his lifelong task, homeopathy has everything to offer. And any homeopath who is out there knows it is a lifetime study, a journey to constantly be searching and researching, understanding each patient as an individual, and having that patient walk into the office as a blank slate and listening closely. Now, Dr. Roberts goes on to say, in the first place, homeopathy offers to the independent mind an opportunity continually to seek new verifications of the natural laws upon which the system of medicine is based. It opens up vast fields to the pioneer, and we cannot gauge the distance that eager minds may travel, nor how greatly the interpretations of these laws may influence the civilization of the future. Homeopathy offers a life of service to humanity, and it is the only method of healing that surely sets the sick man and sick woman on the permanent road to recovery. We must remember that though we may fail, the failure is ours. It is not the failure of homeopathy. The better knowledge we have of the tool of our trade, the better use we should make of them. Homeopathy treats the sick individual. It is therefore a specialty. In spite of the trend toward group practice, group thinking, and even group mode of life, as seen all about us today, we have yet to be convinced that the man is not greater than the mass, and that as long as intelligent thinking people realize and prize their individuality, the individual approach will hold and appeal to them. Therefore, homeopathy offers a special inducement to the man who can teach people to think and act as individuals and to demand medical treatment as individuals. And I might comment here, I again hear an echo of Greg Glazer as he is telling you, find a legal assistant, find somebody who's going to take your case and go with your individual circumstances. What are your beliefs? What are your practices? And how do they apply to the state or federal government? You're not trying to overturn laws at a single bound. No, you're trying to defend that one individual's life to live life naturally peaceful in his own harmonious way and keep stasis and balance in his life based upon his belief system and not be forced by anyone else to do something to his body. And this is really individualized treatment, both medically and legally. Dr. Roberts goes on to say, homeopathy considers the man as a whole, not just his individual parts. Therefore, primarily, homeopathy has less appeal for the man of mechanical bent, for it is this man who makes the best surgeon. Instead, homeopathy offers a gentler way toward health of the entire individual. One thing the student must consider is the differentiation between medicine and public health service. Public health service, ideally, has to do with the prevention of disease in the community, in guarding food and water supplies, in providing facilities and restrictions for adequate, healthy housing conditions, and in attending to the proper disposal of waste matter so that the health of the community will be guarded against epidemics borne by impure water, milk, or other food supplies, or borne in insanitary, unsanitary, and unhygienic conditions. Again, we're hearing an echo of Greg Glazer. Boy, we really have someone who is supporting almost everything that he has said today on the legal side of our lives. Again, on the medical side of our lives, we want someone and a government who is looking out for the best welfare of the community to protect them from toxins, from environmental waste, from overuse of antibiotics, from destroying the natural benefits of raw milk. Many of the things, from putting genetically modified, changed DNA organisms into our food that we, right now, in the United States, as one country, does not label, so we are unaware. It is censorship of information by the United States government. And what can we do to change it? You have to be active and proactive and legislatively active. Dr. Roberts says, medicine ideally has to do with the cure of disease, the building up of the individual, not overlooking the proper hygiene and sanitation, but with a deeper view of the needs of the individual, him or herself, rather than the needs of the community. So homeopathy, he's saying, is individualized medicine. Homeopathic medicine goes even further than this, for homeopathy seeks to relieve the individual as much as possible from the heavy burden of the hereditary tendencies he carries, and to guard against increasing this load by enabling his vital energy to provide its own immunity against disease. Homeopathy looks upon the health of the individual as a precious charge, and the return of the individual to health as almost certain if we but follow the fundamental laws. And so Dr. Roberts here is hinting at the way that homeopathy can actually change the hereditary tendencies so that the person's triggers for those diseases will not be initiated by external forces, or if they are, let's say, in an epidemic disease, how the individual can be strengthened to overcome them with as little detriment and destruction of their health. Dr. Roberts says, another growing distinction between public health service, so-called, and medicine especially homeopathic medicine, is the increasing use of serums and vaccines. It has been claimed that these preparations are really homeopathic. Even instructors in the homeopathic colleges have thought thus to demonstrate homeopathic principles. Let the young man consider this logically. In the first place, giving the identical instead of the similar means the difference between isopathy and homeopathy. You may say that the identical, in the case of the serum or vaccine, is potentiated somewhat as in homeopathy, and therefore it removes it from the identical sphere. Although potentiated, it does not alter the fact that it was not in the first place similar, but identical. In the second place, it has been potentiated in mass production and potentiated and filtered, not through an inert substance, but through living creatures and a lower order of creatures at that. So we can see, even in his very first opening paragraphs to his book about homeopathy and about whether you want to become a homeopath or not, or use homeopathy or not, that he's explaining to the reader that homeopathy and isopathy are different forms of medicine, different approaches to healing, and that homeopathy is using one remedy, and that is potentiated in an inert substance of sugar, of milk sugar or glucose sugar or salts, and whereas these vaccines and serums are potentiated but in dead fetal mouse cells or egg cells, or and they have so many other ingredients and adjuvants and formaldehyde and heavy metals, and you're really injecting something that is not natural into the system. And so he is questioning this method of protecting human immunity, and this is his point of view. He goes on to say, there is a biological law that crossing the blood of higher and lower order of creatures means destruction to the species, and it is well to consider this. Practically, we may well look to the nature of growth in different orders of creatures. When an animal has a longevity of some 20 years, and in that time attains a weight of half a ton, there must be a rapid cell growth. When serum from such a source, though ever so highly filtered, is injected into the human race, where normal longevity is 70 years and where 160 pounds might be considered an average weight, one can well understand the impact upon the vital energy of the human. For while the serum is considered by ordinary medicine to be potentiated past all danger, homeopathy believes that potentiated in any or all forms means a more prompt release of power than may have been possible in the normal state, it then being latent. So what he's indicating here is, yes, you as an individual might have had a potential to a particular disease, organ weakness or something, but when you now inject something into the body that is not natural, you may be actually triggering those potentials of disease in that individual's body that would have remained latent, would have never appeared, would have never had arthritis, would have never had diabetes, but for the injection of foreign matter into the body. And he continues to say, one of the outstanding problems today is cancer. It intrigues the mind of the young man, and his search for the cause and cure of cancer is indefatigable. This is a challenge to the homeopathic physician as well, since he has remedial aids that ordinary practice knows not. But let the young man consider this problem in the light of public health service and in its insistence on the use of serums and vaccines. Let him weigh his ability to stand upon his adherence to fundamental principles. If he takes up the task on the frontier of cancer study, will he remember the relationship between homeopathy, not isopathy, and disease conditions? Or will he forget that human cell tissue is easily stimulated to overgrowth under certain hereditary tendencies? He has here a field for work which offers much elbow room and all the dangers of the pioneer. The homeopathic school accentuates the study of the action of drugs upon healthy human beings, with little consideration of their action on the lower animals. For homeopathy recognizes that it is only through a knowledge of their action on man that we can obtain a correct perception of their applicability in disease. The field here is ripe for much investigation, and the results of such investigation would enrich the homeopathic materia medica by completing provings of some of these older remedies and by bringing out provings of new remedies. And I want to just tell you that provings in homeopathy are very similar to what we think of as a clinical trial. Groups of people that have a double-blind study, they don't know, the person who is giving the material doesn't know what they're giving. The people who are taking the material, the homeopathic energetic substance, don't know what remedy they're taking, and they document all of the mental, physical, emotional changes that they undergo during the period of the study. And so he says this is an opportunity that only homeopathy offers, for the teaching of remedy reaction has ceased in ordinary medical colleges. The decision lies with the individual and what he is determined to secure from his life work. If it is financial ambition, he had better not take up homeopathy. Homeopathy is a principle, and principles brook no division of loyalty. If he has at heart the desire to serve, he may find fame and riches at his door as well, as that keen satisfaction of knowing that he has brought to his clientele the gift of healing in the safest, gentlest, and most rapid manner. For the man who can help the community as individuals toward a higher level of health, the community has a place of honor. For the man who can assist nature to cure serious illness, a certain fame in the community there is burning. Perhaps not the bright flame of the comet, but a steady glow of light for his path. For the man who spends himself unceasingly for those about him, the community will return a comfortable livelihood. Not the spectacular fortune offered in some lines of endeavor, but a competence which will enable him to keep his family in a well-earned place in the community. Homeopathy as a profession carried a challenge. The possibilities of its art are infinite. What future has homeopathy to offer you? Young man, what have you to offer homeopathy? That is the end of chapter one of Herbert Roberts, M.D., The Principles of Art and Cure by Homeopathy. We're going to continue reading again chapter two in another session. But do you hear the echoes of great quotes in history of what do you have to offer rather than what do you want to gain out of this and what are they going to give you? And it also echoes Greg Glaser's talking today about living peacefully natural and his ending today where he said, we must keep a positive attitude. We want to come in walking with good posture, being polite, eating well, living a clean life, being friendly, thinking and meditating in such a good way and looking at others, which is very difficult to do, maybe if you consider companies as individuals, which is totally absurd in today's legal system that it is written that a company is the same as a person, which is totally not true. But if we think about each person as having a soul and looking for the best in them, then we will be living on the light, in the light side. So we've got to do that. We've got to reach each individual at their soul level, at their core, to draw out the best and the lightest part of each person. And today, I know I have been going on for almost a half an hour now, maybe 25 minutes, talking about Dr. Herbert Roberts, who we honor this month. And I hope that you have enjoyed the show. And for the last moment, I do want to let you folks know that if you go to Homeopathy World Community on the right-hand column, we have a special by Miranda Castro, a discount code, whether you're getting ready for the winter and you want some delicious lip balm, whether you want to go or get some of her cell salts, which are supportive at the tissue level, or whether you want to go to Mary Aspinwall's Homeopathy World and check out some of her emergency kits or pregnancy or labor kits, whether you want to go to the Complete Dynamics and purchase the use of that fantastic homeopathic program to use it as a study guide to look up the materia medica, the rubrics, the symptoms, and begin learning that way. Or if you are a professional in the healthcare system, whether you are in chiropractic, acupuncture, a nurse practitioner, or an MD, or a homeopath, that is a fabulous program to get your hands on and have at your disposal right on your desktop. Lastly, we have Kaviraj, who is into organic gardening, homeopathy for farm and garden, and he has done over a decade of investigation using homeopathic remedies for your plants, for your crops, to prevent rust and mold and fungus and bugs. And so that is a fantastic book to investigate for your own personal garden. And of course, below that, we've got all of our regular shows, the archives of our shows, and Kavitha Kukunoor, who has written an inspirational book about her journey from India to the United States as a practicing homeopath. Lastly, we have Grant Bentley, who does facial analysis. And this is a fabulous way to understand what Dr. Herbert Roberts was talking about in terms of hereditary potentials. What does your hereditary line say about you? And he has found, using the structure of the face, that really is our, you know, you say the eyes are the window to the soul. Well, the face has structures in it that are also coming from your heredity, and he uses that to help narrow down the remedy of your choice. So that is our program today. We will be back again on Monday, and Monday we're going to be on the Health In show. You can always check on Homeopathy World Community, the different shows that we have lined up. So for the last show was Anna Vervarchek from Belgium, who talked about her mission walk. And next week, I hope to be talking about mammography, thermoscans, and thermography. And what are the differences? What do you want to know about that for care of your body? And hopefully we will be up with that. If not, we'll find something else to fill in. We've got our shows with Dr. Adil on Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. He's phenomenal. We talk about everything, and he answers your question right on the air. And then that's it for the week, except for Thursdays. So we're going to end today's show completely, and we will see you the next time. And thanks for listening. Send in waves
of
love. Thank
you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Bruck and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.